and find a seat, sit down, enjoy yourself. We're extremely happy here to have Anthony and
Thank you.
I'm very bad at pronouncing, but that's the right way to pronounce it. Who has been visiting here very briefly from the University of California in Santa Cruz, but we hope that it will come back and stay longer. Anthony is somebody who was one of the few people who could yesterday give us a talk about the anthropic principle and the landscape of string theories. And today he's going to tell us about the power of the galaxy.
Cosmology is kind of an interesting time now, because in the last 10 years we've kind of assembled this amazingly detailed picture of what the universe was like between about 1 second and 100,000 years in its early history. We actually know much less about what happened after that, how the universe evolved to what we see, and what happened before that. How did sort of fundamental physics or the very early conditions of the universe give rise to this universe that we know in such detail? And this has led sort of to a little bit of a split personality in cosmology. And in some cosmologists. And as Lee said, I talked about the one side yesterday, and I'd like to talk today about a topic that sort of is at the center of physical cosmology, in the sense that it connects with dark matter, in the sense of gravitational collapse and forming the seeds for the formation of galaxies, gravity, which actually grows perturbations from their initial conditions to the ones we see, those initial conditions, and some of the sort of messy, what's often called gastrophysics of, I'm just going to turn this, often called gastrophysics, that sort of entails the messy hydrodynamics and heat exchange processes and dust and metals and things that all go into galaxy formation. So at its simplest level, galaxy formation is a process in which you start out with more or less homogeneous dark matter and baryons, and they have tiny little fluctuations in the distribution, imprinted from inflation or whatever it is that gives us the perturbations that we see in the microwave background. The dark matter gravitationally contracts, the structures go nonlinear, and we form little halos of dark matter. Meanwhile, the baryons also collapse, but they can do something else that the dark matter can't do, which is cool. So they generically cool, and because they often have some bit of angular momentum, they form an angular momentum supported disk. That disk forms stars, and we have a nice galaxy. Of course, in reality, if that was all there was to it, then this talk would be very short. So we also have to talk about some of the complexities of galaxy formation. Accretion can happen in different ways. Cooling can happen in different ways. Mergers can occur between galaxies that totally change their properties. Mergers or star formation can lead to things that I'll talk a lot about, feedback and outflows. And all of these things have to be folded in sort of a complicated way to see the types of galaxies that we actually observe. So I'm going to talk about two mysteries, I think, in this galaxy formation process, or two sort of ununderstood things involved in the theory of galaxy formation. The first is, despite all these complexities, despite all these sort of complicated stochastic processes that can go into galaxy formation, galaxy properties are amazingly, sort of astoundingly regular. And I'll show you exactly what that means soon. So the first mystery is, how regular are they? What is the regularity that they have, and why are they so regular? The second mystery is, heavy elements like you and I are made of are formed in stars. You all know that. We're all stardust, etc. But stars only form in galaxies. So you would expect that all these heavy elements are confined to galaxies. But observationally, that is not in fact the case. Although we can't make these things primordially in a reasonable cosmology that accords with our observations, we nevertheless see that these heavy elements, which astronomers call metals for strange reasons, but anything over helium, anything heavier than helium is a metal in astronomy. These metals actually exist outside of galaxies in the intergalactic medium. That's the gas pervading the universe out of which the galaxies form. So that's the second mystery. How do those metals get there outside of the galaxy? So spiral galaxies appear to come in many different forms. Things like the Sombrero Galaxy, our neighbor M31, this sort of nice so-called whirlpool galaxy. They have sort of different levels of spiral arms. They have widely different sizes, widely different surface brightnesses, widely different masses by orders of magnitude. But they do have, despite this, sort of striking regularities. One regularity that's been known for a long time is what's called the Tully-Fisher relation, which is that if you look at the rotation velocity of a galaxy, so just the velocity of a star as far away from the center of the galaxy as they orbit the center, the mass of the galaxy is proportional to very close to the fourth power of the rotation velocity. So this is a plot of rotation velocity versus mass, and you can see that from about 10 to the 7 solar masses of a galaxy to about 10 to the 11, so over four orders of magnitude in galaxy mass, this relation is pretty well obeyed. And in fact, people have shown that the scatter in this relation can more or less be attributed to observational error. In other words, there's no need to actually have any deviation in terms of the actual galaxy properties from this relation. All of this scatter can be attributed to just errors in the observations. The error bars are not shown for reasons of not wanting this plot to be a mess. But there's actually much more to this regularity, and it sort of emerged that this deep irregularity was there through a sort of interesting chapter in cosmology and the theory of galaxies. And this takes us back to about 1983, where it was first being appreciated that there was something a little bit strange in galaxies that later became called dark matter. So the idea was, if you look at, as probably a lot of you have seen, if you look at the rotation velocity of the galaxy as a function of the radius, the rotation velocity by Newton's laws is just given by equating the centripetal acceleration to the acceleration caused by gravity from the mass enclosed. And galaxies are actually, they look kind of big and distended, but actually they're quite concentrated. Their mass falls off exponentially from the center. So galaxies, once you get out past a certain radius, are very close to being point masses in terms of what their gravity, the gravity of the observable luminous mass actually would be. So what people expected for galaxies was that the rotation curve would rise for a little bit as you close more and more mass. And then once you got to this approximate point, once a point mass became a good approximation, you just fall off in a Keplerian fall off. That's 1/√r. So that's what they expected. And for a while, they tried to fit rotation curves, apparently, with the data that looked like this. But in fact, when they looked really carefully, what they actually saw was that the rotation curves went flat. They rose, and then they went flat. They went flat. They went flat. They went flat. They always went flat. And what was inferred from this was that the luminous matter, the matter that you actually see and would attribute a Keplerian fall off to, is not all there is. There's some unseen matter. And this is the famous dark matter, of course. But even back then, there was another view. Milgram, with some help later from Bekenstein, asked, could in fact modified gravity rather than dark matter explain these dynamics? So could this deviation of the predictions from the observations just signal that gravity, Newtonian gravity, is not really working when we go to these very large length scales of galaxies? And he called this modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOND. And his proposal was to basically replace Newtonian gravity by a new thing, given by setting this function of, so you compute the Newtonian gravity that you would attribute to the mass that you can see, and then find by this implicit function the real acceleration that comes out of the Newtonian acceleration you would expect, and some fundamental acceleration constant, a naught. So that's some constant with the dimensions of acceleration. And this mu is some arbitrary function that is just made up, as long as it has the properties that it's x for small x and it's 1 for large x.
Tony, isn't there acceleration missing in there?
Oh, yeah, there's an A there. I think that's right. Yeah. Sorry. There's a nicer version of this, which is to replace, rather than just the GMM over R squared force equation, instead to replace the Poisson equation with this new version, which is a little bit awful looking and involves the same mu function. And this is slightly more respectable version in that you can write down at least a non-relativistic Lagrangian that you can derive this equation of motion for. So you can show that momentum and energy and angular momentum are conserved. But in either case, what it boils down to is that when you go to very low accelerations, if you just kind of grind through the math of this, at very low accelerations, below this critical acceleration, A naught, you replace your Newtonian acceleration by the geometric mean of the Newtonian and this fundamental acceleration. So in particular, for a point mass, instead of gm over r squared, you get root gm a naught over r. And the over r is exactly what you want, because equating that to the centrifugal acceleration, you find that the rotation velocity is constant. And in fact, v squared is just root gm a naught. So the delightful thing about that is right away that gives you the Tully-Fisher relation. If you square both sides, you have v to the fourth equals gm a naught. So mass goes as velocity to the fourth. So this modified Newtonian dynamics made a bunch of predictions back in 1983. Rotation curves should be, for isolated galaxies, should be asymptotically flat, not falling off or significantly or rising. The Tully-Fisher relation should be with an index of 4. That was not really known at the time exactly what that index was. They thought it was 3, 4, probably, but it wasn't known as precisely as it is now. And it should be exactly 4. That there'd be a critical surface density, so galaxies come in all sorts of different surface densities, and this predicted that there'd be a critical surface density where what we attributed to dark matter effects would appear. And finally, and sort of most importantly, if you had some distribution of observed matter, you should uniquely, from this formula, be able to predict exactly what the dynamics would be. In dark matter, you have this extra dark matter halo that you stick in with some properties to explain the rotation curve. Here, you wouldn't have that. You predict it directly from the matter that you saw. So he was at the Institute for Advanced Study, and apparently the reaction of the Institute astrophysical establishment was that this theory would be dead by next Tuesday lunch. So how does it fare now, 20 years later? Well, rotation curves are more or less asymptotically flat. And you're thinking about something else, but I don't want to go into that. There are some cases where they're not, but I think Mond has an explanation for that. The Tully-Fisher relationship is right. It's to the fourth. It's very well obeyed. There is this critical surface density where dark matter effects appear. And in fact, there are low surface brightness galaxies that weren't even known to exist when Milgram wrote his paper, which have now been found and seem to be dark matter dominant, just like his theory would have predicted. And finally, and most amazingly probably, is that if you try to do this exercise of taking the taking the visible matter, so these are the rotation curves that the stars and gas individually of the galaxy would have if they were the only gravitating substance, and then apply this Mond formula to them, you get this line as a prediction, and you can barely see that line because it's perfectly covered by the data. And you can do this for another galaxy. This is the stars, this is the gas, this is the prediction, which again you can barely see because it's perfectly covered by the data. And this has been done now for dozens or maybe even more than 100 galaxies of doing this exercise. And all you can say to this is, wow, it really works. It's amazing. For some reason, there is this formula with one parameter that you only get to adjust once, this A naught. And given any galaxy, if you know the mass distribution of the visible stuff, you can just about perfectly predict the dynamics. In other words, you can almost perfectly predict what the dark matter profile of this thing should be.
Is it a different A0 for each galaxy?
No,
it's the same
A0.
But you do actually have to use an additional
parameter M over L. Yes and no. So you have to, there is a parameter M over L, but what you can find is that if you do things in the infrared, that the M over L value that you need is almost always the same. So if you look, say, in K-band luminosity, K-band luminosity traces mass quite accurately. And the M over L that they need in K-band is more or less the same for every galaxy. You can also do it in shorter wavelengths, and in that case you have to worry about the fact that the mass to light ratio from one galaxy to the next varies. But at some level you can guess what the mass to light ratio of the galaxy ought to be by knowing what the color of the galaxy is, because bluer galaxies have more young stars, which are brighter, and they'll have a lower mass to light ratio. So either if you use the infrared bands, you can't do it exactly, but you can come close. Even if you use the infrared bands, or if you use the colors to guess the mass to light ratio, you can just about do this without without needing an adjustable parameter. It's not quite as good. In these fits, they did adjust the MLRF,
yeah,
within
yeah,
small. Yeah, no, that's right.
Sorry, I missed it. What is the forward function mu?
Mu, in this case, is some, they made up some function that's sort of standard in this Mond literature that, I'm not sure if I'll be able to remember the exact form of the function, but I can find it out. It's a function that just has to have those behaviors at the two ends.
But don't these fits depend on the form of that function?
Only very weakly, and it's the same function for all of them. So
it's an actual square root of 1 plus x
square. I think that's the function they use. Okay. So it's some simple function, but it's not something that actually that function was actually chosen in 1992. In some other study, and they use the same one in this one. So it's not something they monkeyed around with a lot, I think, to get the success. It's also worth noting that these are very different types of galaxies. This is a giant spiral, which is dominated by stars. This is a tiny little dwarf, low surface brightness galaxy, more or less dominated by gas, or at least a substantial fraction of it is gas. These are totally different galaxies. This one, for example, is about 3 times the radius of this one, and probably 100 times the mass, but the same formula still works. So there are two sort of natural questions you can ask, seeing this astounding thing. One is, well, is Mond right? Is this really the explanation for what, for the dynamics of galaxies? In other words, should we replace dark matter by modified gravity? And this is kind of a long story in terms of Mond. And there's some reviews, a shorter, more friendly one by me, or a longer one for the Intrepid by Sanders and McGaw. It's an excellent review, much better than this one, but if you limit it on time, you can look at that one. From the theory standpoint, Mond has been a little bit funny because it was really a replacement of Newtonian gravity, not general relativity. So you couldn't do things like predict gravitational lensing, which Newtonian gravity you don't really quite know how to do, or do cosmology with it. And for 20 years, there's been sort of failures after failures to relativize Mond. But recently, there has been some progress. Bekenstein put out a theory that you could do these things in. I know John Moffat has also been attacking similar questions from a relativistic standpoint. So it remains to be seen whether these, at what level these theories can explain some of the things that I'm about to talk about. But in terms of, there are some things that Mond actually makes predictions for example, clusters of galaxies. And there it turns out not to work. You turn out to need additional dark matter in clusters of galaxies. In the intergalactic medium, it also doesn't really work. Structure formation is a little bit unclear, again, because you don't exactly know how to do it without the relativistic theory of Mond, but you can make some sort of assumptions that allow you to calculate structure formation, and it's still a bit unclear. It seems to form a little bit too much structure, a little bit, because and structure forms quite early, but I don't think this ruled it out. Lensing, again, is unclear because you need a relativistic theory, but there are some worrisome things, like lensing signatures that seem to point to structure in the gravitational field or in the gravitational potential of what visibly are very smoothly distributed galaxies. So you see a galaxy that has a very smooth mass distribution, yet some evidence from lensing that it has kind of irregularities in the gravitational potential. This is very hard to account for without dark matter, but dark matter would naturally account for it because there are expected to be little clusters of dark matter that we just can't see. Embedded in galaxies. Finally, I skipped the microwave background. The microwave background is important. The microwave background, I could have just told you this, but Again, you really need a relativistic theory, but there are signatures like the alternation and peak heights from the microwave background that do seem to indicate pressureless matter. So it's the alternation and the peak heights that you probably have seen in this diagram, the three different peaks in the microwave background. The third one is, if not taller, at least not much shorter than the second one. And this comes about basically because you have matter that gravitates but doesn't give pressure when the microwave background is forming. So if that third peak really gets confirmed, then it's not the most beautiful peak, but it should be becoming better soon, whether it's high enough or not. That's going to be really hard to account for in some theory that doesn't have pressureless matter. There are also issues with connecting the amplitude of those primordial perturbations to the amplitude of structure, like in the clustering of galaxies that we measure now. Works beautifully in dark matter. It's not clear that it would work in some alternative theory for that. So given that, what should we make of Mond, or at least what do I make of Mond? I think as modified gravity, it faces many challenges. And modified relativistic gravity is certainly worthy of study and of working out what its consequences are. But I do think the evidence for cold dark matter is really, really strong now. Still, Mond does describe spiral galaxy dynamics stupendously well. And this fitting formula should be tested and used, and people shouldn't be embarrassed, and they shouldn't have to defend using this particular fitting formula to sort of describe or check the systematics of galaxy rotation curves. What that tells us is that galaxy properties are amazingly regular, and they also seem to have this characteristic acceleration scale built in. So then you can ask the second interesting question once you're confronted with this regularity of rotation curves, which is, can standard cold dark matter galaxy formation theory, the simple picture that I showed you with the cooling dark matter halos, which we know from simulations exactly what those halos look like, letting the gas cool like we think that it should, and letting it form stars, can that account for these rotation curves? Well, no. So there are a number of problems. First is that if you look at simulations and you just say that if you look at the natural result of simulations, you find that the Tully-Fisher relation there is the Tully-Fisher relation, but unfortunately has a 3 here instead of a 4. Yeah?
I have a question just to stay on your summary. Can you say something a little more about the issue of pressure? You sort of indicated that Mond just affects pressure. Did I understand that?
When I was talking about the microwave background?
Yeah.
Well, in Mond, when you're forming the microwave background, all there are variables, because you're assuming that there's no dark matter that's acting. So the growth that the density fluctuations that you're looking at, and the evolution of those fluctuations is just given by baryonic matter physics, which has pressure at that time. So it's the signature of the extra component of dark matter that gravitates but doesn't have pressure that causes that alternation in the peak types. And that won't exist if you don't have dark matter. A second problem is that if you run either analytic models or numerical simulations of cosmology where galaxies form and stars form in them, you find that way too many stars actually form. Much too large a fraction of the cosmic gas in the end gets converted into stars that are incorporated in galaxies by a factor of several. So basically, there's too much star formation or too much cooling or something is going on wrong. And that's related to this problem, as it turns out. Third, rotation curve shapes are not really right in the sense that if you take a halo as predicted from some gravitational evolution simulation that just evolves the density perturbations in the dark matter until they collapse into halos, it turns out that there's basically one sort of universal form of galaxy of dark matter halo. It has a few parameters to it, but if you look at the rotation, if you look at an observed galaxy and you say, okay, this is the mass of the galaxy, it should have roughly this mass of the dark matter halo around it, let's try to predict a rotation curve for it, you don't do so good of a job. it turns out that the theoretical halos are too dense in the core, and in particular, so they're sort of systematically wrong, and they're wrong in specifics, which is that they have the predicted galaxy cores, sorry, the predicted galaxy halos have a cusp, so a very steep density profile in the inner part of it, in the inner part of the halo, and that doesn't seem to be observed when they look at galaxies. So there's a sort of systematic problem and a sort of strange cusp versus core problem in the center of these halos. Theoretically, galaxies are too small. That's in simulations or at some level in straight analytic calculations. And so in short, if I were to give some expert galaxy formation theorist the visible mass distribution for a galaxy, there's essentially no way that they would come up with the right rotation curve for it. So the only way they would come up with it is if they put a whole bunch of sort of phenomenological features that they had gotten from fitting a whole bunch of rotation curves. They would never be able to do it from actual theory of structure formation, dark matter, halo formation, and sort of analytic or even numerical simulations of the star formation process. It just, they wouldn't do it. But like I said, if you put a bunch of parameters in, which you get to tune to get the phenomenology right, then you can do it. But from the actual theory, no. And basically the problem is, for several of these problems, is you need to systematically change the relation that you would expect between the baryons and the dark matter to get this right. So a fix that people have come up with, and maybe this is the right fix, is what's known as feedback. The idea of feedback is that as stars, supernovae, and black holes form and accrete matter or go supernovae or radiate, they give off lots of energy. The energy heats the gas, moves the gas around, moves dust around, which is connected to the gas, and essentially change the dynamics of the gas around the forming stars or quasars or supernovae. And this can result in a lot of effects. One is that gas can actually be blown out of galaxies. This is called galactic wind. So basically, you give so much energy to the gas that it just becomes unbound, and the gas flows out in some sort of outflow from the galaxy. In a slightly less drastic manner, star formation can be prevented by just locally heating up the gas. Hot gas can't collapse into structure or cool nearly as well as cooler gas. And so by just heating up the local environment that would normally form stars, you can stop star formation, or at least slow it down. And this is often called a multi-phase fluid description, meaning that you have both a cold phase that's forming stars and a really hot phase that's heated up by the stars, and you have to take into account both. Finally, you can prevent gas from actually cooling or accreting onto a galaxy, either by heating up the gas around the galaxy to provide additional pressure, or by driving one of these winds that just kind of fights against the accretion of gas onto the galaxy and prevents the galaxy from growing. Now, all these effects depend on galaxy mass, the environment, the history, how old the galaxy is, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of complicated to, in any realistic way, put these into a galaxy formation scenario. People nonetheless do it. The way they implement this feedback procedure is to put all the physics that they know about here. They put feedback, which is represented by this control panel with lots of knobs that you can turn, and do various sort of arbitrary things to the input from these physics, and then you get your galaxy out. And when you put this extra sort of function in, it helps. It's not the same sort of implementation of this control panel in every galaxy formation model. The galaxy formation models done with simulations have some extra bit of computer code that you put in that tries to take into account this feedback while the simulation is running. Analytic calculations have some extra function that they put in that says a galaxy of such and such a mass will eject this much gas at this much time at this redshift, etc. And when you put these in, they help. So you can reduce the total amount of star formation in sort of an obvious way. And if you choose analytically or sort of observe numerically to have more mass loss from low mass galaxies, then you help with this Tully-Fisher relation problem, because before it was too shallow. So if at the low end you take away mass, you end up making that relation steeper. So you can basically get this exponent of 4 that you needed by taking away more and more baryonic mass as you go to lower and lower mass galaxies. So it helps with a lot of these mysteries. Does it solve all of the problems? It's not clear that it does. In particular, this problem with the cores or cusps in the center of galaxies, it's not clear that feedback really helps with that. In fact, at some level, it may make it worse. But a lot of these other systematic things it does. Another question you might think is, if this really is some messy stochastic process, for example, winds may be triggered by mergers, which only happen to some galaxies, or they might only happen at some cosmic epochs, or they might depend on environment. With such a messy process, how is that going to lead to something that can be fit by one function? And finally, can we do better than this in terms of understanding what feedback actually is or how to incorporate it into our galaxy formation models? And that brings us to the second mystery, that of how these heavy elements got out of galaxies. And the relation between the two is reasonably clear in the sense that because these metals are outside of galaxies, it indicates that there's some process that's blowing gas out of galaxies, like a galactic wind or some feedback process. So there clearly should be some link between the feedback that we need to fix galaxy formation models and the feedback that we need to provide these intergalactic metals. So this is part of the motivation for pursuing a study of these intergalactic metals to try to get some handle on outside of the thing that the feedback is invoked to fix, that is galaxy formation, to get some handle on this feedback in a way that wasn't just assuming what you want to show. So how do we know these metals are there in the high redshift intergalactic medium? Well, what we actually see is that this is sort of a slice out of a numerical simulation of the universe. This is 10 megaparsecs by 10 megaparsecs long. And what this indicates is we look at some very distant object, a quasar. We look at the line of sight that's passing through this intergalactic medium. So these are regions of high density, these filaments, and big void regions of low density. And each time each time we intersect one of these dense regions, we end up absorbing, because of the neutral gas, which is a small fraction, but present in these structures. So each one of these structures shows up as an absorption line in a spectrum. So for example, this one might correspond to this absorption line, this one might correspond to this absorption complex. And so by looking at one of these absorption spectra with all these little absorption lines in it, we can map out exactly what the distribution of hydrogen is in the intergalactic medium. And that tells us how the structure is forming, what this cosmic web, so it's called, looks like, et cetera. This is also a prime tool for looking at metals in the intergalactic medium. So this is a real quasar spectrum. And what you see here is the basic shape of the emission from the quasar. That goes here, up, this is a Lyman alpha emission line, and up there. And all this stuff that looks like noise here is actually signal. It's all the absorption from all those individual little structures. So what's great about this field is this is a ridiculous amount of data telling us about the structure of the intergalactic medium, because each one of these little dips that you can't even see is indicating some absorption line that we can do statistics of and calculate the compare to simulations, et cetera. But it doesn't just tell us about the hydrogen gas. So this is the part that is in the wavelength range where hydrogen will do some absorbing of the light from on the way as it comes from the quasar to us. But you also see this other region over here. And what these correspond to is also not noise. The noise is basically tiny stuff up here. It's a little bit bigger over here, but it's tiny on the scale. This other stuff is absorption by metal lines. So for example, carbon and silicon and nitrogen all have transitions in their spectra where they absorb at these wavelengths, and we can pick them up. So if we look at some region of the spectrum, we can look at absorption by some bit of hydrogen gas. We can look at the region of the spectrum where that same gas would be absorbing if there were carbon in it and see if there's carbon absorption. And in this case, there is. So carbon actually comes in a doublet, so there's two sort of identical absorption copies that correspond to this hydrogen absorption.
Is this atomic carbon?
This is, yes, it's atomic, and it's triply ionized, in this case, carbon. It's called carbon. Again, perverse astrophysics notation, carbon 4 is triply ionized carbon. So clearly, by sort of looking at the absorption strength of this, that tells us something about how much of this carbon there is. This absorption strength tells us something about how much hydrogen there is. By comparing them, we can see how much, what the carbon to hydrogen ratio is. And that tells us about how much of this metallicity there is. So this has been a game that's been played for the past 10 years or so. These metals were discovered in this gas that, you know, it was actually quite a surprise because they thought that this gas far away from galaxies would just be pristine. It would just be perfect gas left over from the Big Bang. They were quite shocked to see these metal lines in it. That was about 10 years ago. And they found that you could see, for example, carbon, silicon, and oxygen in gas that was about 5 or more times the mean density of the universe. So that's sort of slightly to very overdense structures corresponding to those filaments that you saw earlier. It's harder to see what's going on in the lower density void regions. And that it typically had about 1/1000 to 1/100th of the solar metallicity, of the metallicity of the sun. So this is very low metallicity stuff, but it's not at all pristine. So this started a lot of speculation about how these metals got out there. And so there were a lot of proposals for various different feedback processes involving collisions between galaxies, galactic winds, individual supernovae, dust being driven out of galaxies. Dust is also a form of metals, but in solid form. Jets from quasars and active galactic nuclei. And all kinds of different combinations of things, like supernovae driving galactic winds, or collisions driving galactic winds, or dust driving galactic winds, or collisions triggering AGNs, or AGNs driving dust that's connected to gas that drives a galactic wind. So there are lots of different things that have been bandied about. And I have to admit some culpability in this. I've thought about a number of these models. And I think maybe responsible for at least one. But it's useful in sort of analyzing what these metals are telling us to divide them into some basic scenarios. So one basic scenario we could take, which I didn't mention in that one, but is in principle testable, is that there was primordial enrichment. So it happened at, you know, nucleosynthesis, a very high redshift. Nobody actually believes that, but it has the virtue of being tested. Another possibility is that there was a sort of high redshift, very active phase of the universe when the first stars formed, and or the first small galaxies and stars formed. And outflows from these very first galaxies and stars provided this intergalactic enrichment. This would be nice at some level because it would give us a window into stuff that was happening so early in the universe that, that we can't currently or directly observe it. So this would be nice in that sense. And there are also good reasons to expect that this might be a good candidate for infecting the Lyman alkali, sorry, infecting the intergalactic medium, such as these very small galaxies existing in early times would be much easier for the gas to escape than very large galaxies at later times. So I'm just going to lump this sort of scenario into what I'll call early enrichment, that is very high redshift enrichment. And the key attribute of this early enrichment will be that what it will look like is that metals have more or less just been sprinkled into the universe at high redshift than we can see, with some distribution, but without really affecting the dynamics of the gas outside of galaxies very much. So that's why it's sort of the sprinkle model. Another possibility is that at later times, at high redshift, but redshifts that we can still actually observe, there was strong feedback that happened sort of universally in galaxies. And what this would do is not just blow gas out of galaxies, but it would actually heat up the medium outside of the galaxies. So all this gas flowing out of the galaxies would shock with the gas that's already out there, heating it up and changing its dynamics. And a great virtue of this model is that we actually observe these galactic winds both in the current universe and at very high redshift. So an example of a currently observed galactic wind, that's a little icon for the strong blowing galactic winds, is a neighboring galaxy called M82. This is sort of an interesting galaxy. It's forming stars at a very high rate. And this is what it looks like in the optical. So you just basically see this disk, you see all the star formation, you see all this dust that's coming out of the star formation. But if you look at this in H alpha, which looks at hotter gas, you actually see this. So you see the galaxy you saw before, but you also see this biconical outflow. And if you measure either using lines in this gas or using X-ray, which you can see here, this is the same galaxy in X-ray, you see also these two big plumes. You can measure it. I think that is the same scale. I tried to get it as close as I could. Yeah. So you can see a little bit farther in X-ray than in H alpha. I wouldn't vouch for it being exact. You can see that these winds move at about 200 to 800 kilometers per second out of the galaxy. And that's, for reference, bigger than the escape velocity from the galaxy. So you can, from this one, it would be probably a couple of hundred kilometers per second escape velocity. So there's a good chance that these winds are going to actually get out, like you would expect if you wanted them to capture the enrichment. So this will be the third model, which is that there will be winds from late galaxies which will heat up the intergalactic medium and change the dynamics of the intergalactic medium and provide lots of metals. And this is the sort of scenario we would actually want if we thought that these galactic winds or these outflows played a big role in accounting for the properties of galaxies. That's where we got to this problem in trying to sort of fix standard galaxy formation theory. So how can we distinguish, using the observations of these metals in the intergalactic medium, which of these scenarios is most realistic? So there are a number of things we could do. We could look for evolution of the metallicity. Clearly, there won't be any if no metals are being put into the intergalactic medium. We can look at the temperature of the gas. We know what it should be from theory if there isn't any effect of these winds on the gas, so we can check that. We can look at the amount of metals that we see and compare that with how much we would expect to come from the galaxies. We can look at how it's distributed. If it comes from little galaxies, which are sort of more closely spaced and more common, it should be more widespread than if it comes from big galaxies, which are rare. And we can look at ratios, so abundance ratios, to see what kind of stars might have been forming these elements. So different mass stars, for example, or stars with different amounts of metals in them, will form different ratios, say, of carbon to silicon or silicon to oxygen, et cetera. And it turns out we can do all this. All it takes is a few years and a huge amount of effort. So the way this works, the way we actually take one of these quasar absorption spectra and learn stuff about it, is we take the spectrum, we look at the absorption in individual pixels, so just individual sort of wavelengths in the spectrum. We take numerical simulations from cosmological simulations that include hydrodynamics. We take a model, and this is important for the background, the UV background in the universe, because that background determines how much carbon is in triply ionized versus doubly ionized or quadruply ionized carbon. And that's important because we actually see triply ionized carbon. So we have to make a correction from that to total carbon. And that requires knowing what this UV background model is, and we can get that sort of from other means. So I could explain in detail how this all works, but I think you'd be much happier if I indicated this way. We put all these things into a black box, and we get results, which I'm going to tell you. So the first result we get is that if we look at the median carbon metallicity, it actually depends on the density of the gas. It's also highly inhomogeneous. So the enrichment is higher in dense regions of the universe, but even at every density, the enrichment is very different. So what this is showing is the density of the gas from sort of the mean density of the universe to about 100 times the mean density. This is the metallicity, and you can see that there's this trend, and it's a quite significant trend. These are showing how much scatter there is. So this is what each point is telling you, is that, for example, here, there's about an order of magnitude scatter in the metallicity at a given density. So it's very inhomogeneous.
Can you say what delta was? Sorry, I'm...
Sorry, yeah, delta was the ratio of the density to the average cosmic density. So this is here, the log delta of 0, that's the mean density, and here is 100 times the mean density.
I just understand the black box a little bit more. Are these measurements of individual systems, or are they a set of statistical stacking?
This is statistic. So each one of these corresponds to a particular, I don't have another figure that might be useful, but it's not quite a system. It's basically a bin of pixels, individual absorption pixels in the spectrum, put into bins, and each one of these comes from one of those bins. So it's not an individual system. I don't want to go too much into the technique, but what we use is called pixel statistics, which doesn't look at systems, but just individual absorption elements. So this is what people might have expected, that the metallicity was inhomogeneous and lower at low density, but it had never been observed before. And what it does do is certainly rule out that primordial metals, because there's really no way to make primordial metals look inhomogeneous. But even if you did make them look inhomogeneous, there'd be no way to make them vary with density like that, unless they were coming from in some way connected to what the actual density or the galaxy would do. The second thing we observed was that the metallicity didn't evolve from redshift 4 to about redshift 2. So this is the metallicity. These now are individual quasars, so we had about 20 quasar spectra. And we see that basically nothing happens from redshift 4 to redshift 2. So clearly this favors enrichment that actually happened in redshift bigger than 4, or else we'd see some evolution. There's a little bit of room within the errors for some addition of metals at lower redshift. And so this is going to favor the sprinkling model over the blowing model, which happens more at low redshift. Third, we thought, well, it would be nice if we could get some handle on the temperature of the intergalactic gas. And it turns out you can actually do that, because the ratios of doubly to triply ionized carbon and doubly to triply ionized silicon are quite sensitive to the density and the temperature of the gas. And by measuring those ratios, we could find that the observed metals are in photoionized warm gas, not really hot collisionally ionized gas that you might expect if winds were blowing into the intergalactic medium to provide this enrichment. So they all seem to be coming from sort of normal quiescent gas, exactly like in the sprinkle model. Additionally, the ratios of carbon to silicon are sort of reasonable and also don't evolve. So the sprinkle model looks better and better from these observations. Another exercise we can do, which is an interesting one, is to calculate the total amount of metal that we would expect. This is done in units of the critical density, so omega dark matter is 0.3, omega carbon is 2 times 10 to the minus 7, omega silicon is 3 times 10 to the minus 7. Makes you feel a little bit insignificant, I guess, compared to the dark energy, because that's you, carbon and silicon. But the interesting thing to compare that to is the total amount of silicon, say, you would expect to be in stars. That's where most of the silicon you would think would be in. And it's only about twice as much that's in stars, even if they have solar metallicity, which is higher metallicity than you expect them to have at the redshifts that we're looking at. So the bottom line of what this tells you is that stars actually only hold sort of less than 60 or 70% of the silicon in the universe at the time that we're looking at. The rest has to be in the intergalactic medium. So lots of metals get into the intergalactic medium where the, I think I introduced this term, but I'm not sure, the Lyman-Alpha forest is what this is called in astrophysics circles. What this tells us is that metal ejection is quite efficient, at least before redshift 3 or 4. And in fact, it's not even clear whether normal enrichment scenarios from very high redshifts could provide this. There's also another strange thing, which is that if you look at the intergalactic medium in clusters, so this is in a cluster, there's bound gas, also out of galaxies. There you can measure the metals in a different way using X-ray emission from this hot gas. And you find that currently, so this is at redshift 0 rather than redshift 3, clusters have about 100 times as much metallicity as you can see at these early stages of the Lyman-Alpha forest. So this tells us one of two things. Either there's evolution in the metallicity. Oh, sorry, I should also mention that we don't see any regions of the Lyman Alpha forest that have that high of metallicity. All of it is lower metallicity. So this tells us either that there's evolution in the metallicity between the redshifts we're looking at early on and now, or somehow there are metals hidden in the hot gas. And this is actually quite possible because as the gas is really hot, the fraction of triply ionized carbon basically vanishes, and our signature of these metals goes away. So if there were really, really hot gas, such as there is in clusters, we wouldn't see it in these quasar absorption techniques. We would only see it in this X-ray emission technique at low redshift. So what this is telling us is that it's a bit of a strange picture, because while the things that we see aren't totally consistent with early enrichment, there are other reasons, like the fact that we need lots of enrichment or lots of outflows to fix galaxy formation. And this evolution that we see from the cluster evidence to suspect that strong winds are also sort of necessary. So this led us to take sort of another approach, which is to take cosmological simulations that have incorporated the physics of these winds directly into them. So instead of just predicting the dark matter or the gas dynamics, they did the gas dynamics with galaxy formation plus a prescription for adding galactic winds that would drive outflows from the galaxy. So this would be something with a few knobs that they put into this simulation. And we did this for two different simulations with different prescriptions, different knobs for this feedback. This is one of them. Where is it? There it is. Where on the left, on the right, you see the temperature of the gas. On the left, you see the metals that are in the gas. So you see that there are some regions, like this proto group or cluster, that have lots of metals. The gas gets very hot. There are other regions with basically no metals, far away from the galaxies. And in between, you get some very inhomogeneous distribution. So this is more or less what you might expect, knowing about how galaxies are distributed, et cetera. It's also important to note that where the metals are is also where the gas is hot. This kind of gas is the sort of photoionized gas that you can see easily in the Lyman Alpha forest.
How hot are those?
So these, now they're gone, but so this is the temperature scale here, you can see. So it's going to get to between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6. And I'll give a figure that shows more in detail what the temperatures are.
And how hot are the observed gas, the observed metals?
They seem to be less than 10 to the 5. So I'm going to get to this in detail. So what we can then do is compare these different simulations and what we should observe in the absorption of these simulations to what we do observe. So this is what we do observe. This is a simulation where we don't put any of these feedback things in, but we just sprinkle in metals with some distribution. And they work fine, largely because we choose the distribution so that this works fine. These are the simulations. They all kind of fail badly in the sense that they don't give enough absorption. They don't give enough signature of this carbon to account for our observations. We can also look at, remember, the carbon 3 to carbon 4 told us about the temperature of the gas, comparing those simulations to the observations. The simulation without winds works fine, but we just sprinkled in the metals. The simulations with these strong winds putting the metals in don't work. They're way off. And the problem in both cases is, as you might guess, that the gas is too hot. The gas carrying the metals is too hot, and it's at too low densities. So if you look at this plot, this gives a scatter plot of the particles in the simulation. These are the temperatures. This is the metallicity. If you look here, these blue particles are low density, high metallicity particles. So these are the things that are sitting out in the intergalactic medium. And they're all roughly between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 Kelvin. Outside of the range where the observations see the metals, which is kind of in here. So it's a mess. One possible rescue for this is that something that hasn't been incorporated into the simulations and should have been is cooling by the presence of metals. So it turns out that the metals themselves contribute to the cooling, and this can have a significant effect. So we tried putting in a prescription for taking into account that effect. When things got better for the carbon 4, for the carbon 3, they got even worse. And basically, this happens because the gas is too low density. Finally, there's a third problem, which is that if you look in detail at the distribution of the absorption you see, the simulations can't explain the distribution. The simulations basically have a metallicity distribution that's too inhomogeneous. And this stems from the fact that sort of too small a fraction of the universe actually gets enriched by these large galaxies that are driving the winds in these simulations. And you can sort of see this in the fact that most of the gas in these simulations is metal 3, which is this sort of bar down here, versus this little bit up here that's actually metal rich. So it's a small filling factor, and it just isn't enough to account for the observations. So in summary, these galactic winds, these strong galactic winds that are in the simulations are hot and have a low filling factor, but observations seem to indicate an absorption or metallicity that's cool, relatively high filling factor, and in the filaments. And the simulations can't reproduce the carbon 4 or the carbon 3 or the distribution. But with the caveats that you need to put metal cooling in these simulations. And a second and important one is that these simulations don't seem to be able to explain the observations in the sense that they always provide too little absorption. But they're not really incompatible in the sense that if you sprinkled metals in on top of the metals that are given by the simulations, then you can match the observations. So in other words, the observations are sort of compatible with winds, but the winds can't actually explain them. It seems you need some extra ingredient. So these two mysteries, the regularity of galaxies and the necessity and these intergalactic metal observations, make sort of a conundrum, because you need strong feedback to suppress the star formation to not overproduce stars. Strong feedback is observed in star-forming galaxies. Strong feedback has to be more or less ubiquitous if you want that to be the explanation for why Milgram's fitting formula works so well. And there are lots of metals in the intergalactic medium. On the other hand, metals sprinkled in by hand, sort of, in non-feedback simulations reproduce everything that we currently observe in these intergalactic medium metallicity spectrum observations. And state-of-the-art simulations with exactly the sort of strong feedback that you need to keep the stellar mass from being too big and explain the properties of galaxies totally fail to explain the observed metals. So it's a bit mysterious. I have to say, I would have expected not to have seen such a discord between what we saw in these observations and what we hope to see on the basis of other evidence. So my best guess as to what's going on is, I think probably when, at the end of the day, feedback and outflows indeed do occur more or less universally in galaxies, both when they're forming and through sort of the early part of their life where they're forming a lot of their stars. And I think until we understand this feedback and understand the role it plays and exactly how it works, we're never really going to understand galaxy formation or the success of Milgram's fitting formula for galaxies. I think it's sort of, at some level, the unsolved problem of galaxy formation is understanding this feedback process. Because Milgram's fitting formula works so well, we might expect that even though feedback is kind of a messy process, it seems to have a very regular effect, and therefore we might expect some fairly regular theory describing this feedback, or some regular way of describing this feedback in galaxy formation theory, to work. So we might expect, at the end of the day, a fairly nice theory described. I just wish I knew what that theory was. My guess is that early feedback was strong, and in fact accounts for what we're seeing in the intergalactic medium in these quasar absorption measurements. Late feedback probably is also strong, But my guess is that the effects of that feedback are largely hidden. Basically, they're just heating up the gas to a level where we can't observe it in these quasi-absorptive spectra, and we can only see it at later times in clusters. So that's my guess as to what the resolution of this kind of paradox is. And in sort of fitting all this together and coming up with some sort of cohesive model of galaxy formation, explaining the dynamics of rotation curves, the Tully-Fisher relation, the connection with these outflows and the intergalactic medium, I think there are a number of clues that would be really helpful to have. One would be just having more data on the metals at all redshifts. So looking, for example, at higher redshifts to see if we can then see some evolution in the metallicity if it was coming from an early effort. We need better simulations of winds from individual galaxies to try to tie the properties of outflows to what's happening in individual galaxies in a way that only simulations can really provide, because only simulations can really track some of these messy processes in a way that maybe we can then approximate analytically or sort of theoretically in some sort of nicer model. We also need to be able to figure out what kind of connection there is between realistic feedback as given by numerical simulations or perhaps observations of individual galaxies to the properties of those galaxies, so that we might be able to put those as ingredients into some nice theory of galaxy formation. And finally, we need realistic feedback in simulation. So we need to take kind of these ingredients and figure out how to put feedback in a realistic way into these simulations so that we can then run them, do this comparison again, and hopefully have a little bit more success. So that's what I have to say about the two mysteries. Thanks. So the idea was that the effect of it is just to put the metals in without disturbing the gas. But the idea behind it is that it's either the first stars, population 3 stars, or that it's rather high redshift galaxies, so galaxies at redshift say 10 to 15, which are low enough mass that in the outflow that's able to escape from one of these galaxies, the velocities would be slow enough that they would shock to a temperature that was only 10 to the 4 or a little bit over 10 to the 4 rather than 10 to the 7. So the effect of those outflows would be more or less just to kind of puff into the intergalactic medium and then settle down and not really do much significant to it. It's later galaxies where you need an escape velocity of 200 kilometers per second and hence a shock temperature of 10 to the 6 or so, or 10 to the 7, that get you into trouble because those really heat up the intergalactic medium and it doesn't have a chance to cool. So that's the scenario, is that it's the first stars or very high redshift small dwarf galaxies.
Second question was about the simulations of galaxy formation. How early are those simulations?
These are the cosmological simulations?
Well, or you quoted the results of those simulations.
There are lots of different things that people do. So one thing that people do is run a cosmological simulation and look at the galaxies that form within it. So those are cosmological simulations. Yeah, and they start at very high redshift.
So wouldn't it suppose that the Hubble constant, the Hubble fell is different from what we think? Wouldn't that affect
I think the Hubble, just the value of the Hubble constant is not going to change. It will change, I think, the sort of zero point of that Tully-Fisher relation, but not the slope of it. If the cosmology is wrong, you know, in some basic way, like the lambda CDM cosmology is just not right, and the evolution is different, then that will have an effect, but I'm not sure exactly what that effect would be. Just changing the Hubble constant, I think, would.
Suppose the constant time instead of not just different values.
Yeah, it could have some effect, but I'm not sure exactly what it would be. My guess is not a big effect because that mass going is velocity cubed comes from a pretty basic argument of sort of what happens when dark matter plus halo forms at a given mass. So it's sort of, you can more or less do it on the back of an envelope that you expect that V cubed, which comes out of the simulations. So it would have to be something pretty drastic to change that.
Would you expect a difference in behavior of the galactic winds in the high surface brightness galaxies to the low surface brightness galaxies as a possible explanation of, for example, on your Tully Fisher plot, assume that you had organized the gases into the high surface brightness red dots versus the low surface brightness green ones. And for the low surface brightness galaxies, their critical surface density is outside the molar G. And so to do their fits, they use, I think, the hydrogen gas, which increases and has a bigger effect on low surface brightness galaxies than high surface brightness galaxies. And so I'm just wondering if there's a correlation with the wind and whether you can get a more noticeable effect in low surface brightness galaxies.
It's a bit tricky. It's the thing you expect to be very related to what the effect of winds is the galaxy mass, because the winds tend to have sort of basic arguments tend to suggest that the winds will escape from galaxies below sort of a certain escape velocity of 100 kilometers per second or so, but have trouble with more massive galaxies. Surface density is sort of an interesting one, because the winds are supposed to be driven by star formation. And observationally, the winds only occur actually if there's a star formation rate per unit area which exceeds some value. So that would seem to suggest that winds should preferentially leave high surface brightness galaxies. And it's not really clear that that's what you want in order to fix this problem, because the effects of dark matter, the sort of Mond effect, is more in low surface brightness galaxies than in high surface brightness galaxies. So it's not even clear that this effect goes in the right direction.
Now, if it's the other way around, in low surface brightness galaxies, the critical surface density is outside the molar G.
It's below, the surface density is below the critical surface density.
And so the behavior of low surface brightness galaxies is purely due to the components of Newtonian.
No, that's, you have it opposite. It's in low surface brightness galaxies, we infer the dark matter is dominating, and in Mond, they infer that the gravity is very modified in low surface brightness. So it's below the threshold that Mond becomes important.
There's another question here. I think it's something
I haven't done. Okay, John. The initial space in the glass size. The pressure was massive.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like, then the frame is a little bit of a more spectrum effect. However, I think there is a couple of questions for
So in his fits, the background of this is that one of the Mond proponents has tried to fit the microwave background with just a purely baryonic model. And you do have to do some strange things. You have to, just to get the sort of widths of the peaks, it turns out right, you have to either introduce introduce fairly massive neutrinos as sort of an extra dark matter component, or you have to make the universe a little bit curved, which may be okay. And you have to pick a somewhat strange Hubble constant, I think. That's right. What it doesn't account for, though, is so. This only works because the data on the third peak, which would really sort of indicate how much of this alternation of peak heights there is not that strong from the first release of the WMAP data. The second release should be happening, well, months ago, but really any time now it should be coming out. And when it does, I think that third peak is going to be very well nailed down, and then I think we'll see whether his model can possibly account for that or not. I think if CDM is right, that should come back in a way that's virtually impossible for him to account for. But who knows, he's a clever guy, let's see.
If I remember right, one of the things in favor of matter, dark matter halos, from some instability in the galactic disk, and that's what you had. So how does the modern folk affect?
So there is, there's a claim by Milgram and one of his students working this out in MOND that MOND also provides extra stability to a plain disk. I haven't myself read that really carefully to tell you whether I really believe that or not, but I suspect that they're probably right that it does. So there is an explanation of that, but I haven't looked at it in detail.
I would say that I agree.
You agree that it's reasonable?
Let me take time to pose a quick question.
Okay.
If the drift of the second part of your prompt is off, it really is some modified theory of stability dynamics, is there a smoking gun that observers can report that would tell us that in no way it could work with some dark matter or the feedback?
Smoking gun for Mott, let's see. I think you'd, I'll have to think about that. That's a very good question as to what we could observe. I think we'd have to see there are things you can think of, lots of things that where dark matter could go wrong. So for example, you could have the lensing mass of some object not be the dynamical mass of it. That doesn't seem to have happened, but in principle, it could well. So one of these early MOND theories that got lensing totally wrong could have been right, and you know, lensing would totally disagree with what dark matter predicted. So that's one possibility. There could be no substructure in galaxies. So these lensing things have indicated substructure that could not have been there or go away or something like that. So smoking guns are hard, but I'll keep thinking about that. There are lots of little things that could go, but definitively, I'll have to think about what would be definitive.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.